So we went out, we went back to our quarters, and then the next day another plane took us down through the monsoon, flew down into Rangoon. And at Rangoon we were getting ready to go down to Singapore with the surrender, but unfortunately the local commander in Singapore refused to surrender, and he kept putting out broadcasts, "Don't come down, don't come down, we shall fight you." And finally the emperor, as he did in several other quarters of the South of Asia, had to fly out representatives of his family to order the local commander to surrender. And General Itagaki, I think it was, I'm not sure, and I forget now, in Singapore. But for a week anyway, or 10 days, the whole armada was stalled because of the fact that the local commander in Singapore was not going to surrender. However, he did, and I went in with the second wave. I didn't go in with the first wave into Singapore. I went in with the second wave about four or five days after the initial wave of troops had gone in. Of course, the occupation of Singapore, the fight to occupy Singapore, had the bombs not been dropped and had Japan not surrendered, was due to take place in September, October of 1945, parallel with the American invasion of the mainland of Japan. So all the preparations had been made, and as a matter of fact, the first wave anyway went in full battle order, sort of bayonets drawn and respirators at the alert, and they found the Japanese in Singapore neatly drawn up with on the docks with trucks all labeled and their quarters all arranged for them. It's funny this, you know, the Japanese can do a complete somersault. Now, this is historic. If two warriors fought one another, the one that was defeated immediately turned over and became the willing servant of the one who'd beaten him. And this was so in their own reaction to the surrender. I was down in Singapore for another 6 weeks or so, and to the best of my knowledge, I don't know of one incident from 500,000 troops surrendered. One incidence of defiance of the American British occupying forces. There may have been, but anyway, we went down to Singapore, and my section, the Japanese section, was ordered to take over all the Japanese newspapers in Singapore and the radio broadcasts, because there had been, in addition to the Japanese military, there had been a fairly substantial number of Japanese civilians working in Singapore during the war in various capacities, and probably 300 or 400 of them, and we were given these people to look after. In addition, we were given the printing facilities. We took over all the printing facilities, we took over the radio facilities, and we began putting out, first of all, a newspaper to the surrendered Japanese forces, and then my job, a daily radio broadcast to the Japanese surrendered forces in Southeast Asia, of whom, as I say, there were some 500,000. As a matter of fact, I had been privileged to see the initial surrender, which was held at Rangoon, taken by General Browning, and went out to the airport to see the Japanese generals fly in from Saigon. And it was there at Government House in Rangoon that the terms of the surrender were arranged with the Japanese army, and although the formal surrender was taken by Mountbatten at Singapore, the actual surrender ceremony itself was at Government House, Rangoon. I was very lucky to see it in company with a Japanese Canadian, Nisei, friend of mine, who was also out there. And so we went down to Singapore, and my job was to put out a daily broadcast, or to supervise the putting out of a daily broadcast to the Japanese forces. And this was done under my direction by an extremely fine Japanese civilian whose family was connected with Domei, the Japanese news agency, and who subsequently became head of Domei, and very distinguished man in Japan. He died last year, I understand. But he and I would go down, and he would read what we had prepared for him to read, the news, and I stood with my hand on the switch following the broadcast and prepared to throw it in case he said something that was wrong. He's a most delightful person, highly cultured, extremely westernized, a traveler in Europe, loves Chopin, just a marvelous fellow. And we put all these Japanese civilians, we took them and we put them out in a farm on the outskirts of Jurong, on the outskirts of Singapore, and beyond feeding them, giving them sufficient rice, left them to their own desserts. And it was quite amazing. Within 6 weeks when I left, they had a complete organized community going, just like an anthill, moving around. There were schools going. They had cannibalized a number of automobiles in which they'd driven out. The Japanese had put them out there before we came at this farm because they knew that we were coming in to invade Singapore, and they didn't want civilians in the way, so they sort of put them out of the way, and that's where we found them. But they'd gone out in old automobiles, and they'd cannibalized these automobiles, and they had to make a power plant, and they had built a little dam and had running water. They had schools going. They chose their leaders quite naturally, without any argument. It was apparent who was going to be lead, and they were divided down into sub-leaders and so on. It was an amazing piece of organization, and I think right there, if you'd watched it, you could have seen the beginning of the Industrial Revolution that took place in Japan. They're fantastic organizers. And as today, whilst in America direction comes from the top, in Japan it starts at the top, then it goes down to the bottom, and then like a cork it comes up, slowly rising until war is achieved, consensus. That is why they are a little slower at arriving at decisions, but once the decision is taken, there's no opposition to it. Unlike us, where the decision is made at the top and then is very often fought by putting in because there hasn't been the input from downstairs. So this was the way they organized. They're fantastic people, and I came away with a very, very different idea of the potential of Japan after the war than I had when I went into it, thinking of them just as imitators and rather sort of baroque little people who really weren't
American. Was that one of the kind of cliches that you had even perhaps been reinforced during your Japanese language training school? Was that one of the general...
No,
cliches of the time?
No, it certainly wasn't. It certainly wasn't taught by Major Mackenzie and his staff, but it was the popular one. It was the fallacy that we all had, wasn't it, before the war? The war proved somewhat different. And no, that was never told. We were told they were an honest people, and in many ways a good-hearted people who had just been sidetracked by the military into a wrong course of events. But we were, the Japanese people were never denigrated at the school in any way at all. We were not taught to think of them that way. But nevertheless, it was only when you went out and saw them that you began to realize the potential, their tremendous potential, which has proved itself since. Now, we did have, which is another story altogether, with a great deal of reluctance, as you know, Mackenzie King did finally give his consent to the British recruiting in the camps, young Japanese to be enlisted into the British Army for service in Southeast Asia as interpreters and so on. And a British Army officer now living in Victoria came out and recruited probably something like 80 or 90, maybe 100 of these young Japanese Nisei from the various camps around British Columbia and elsewhere. And just as they were to leave, the first batch, about 30 of them, just as they were to leave, Mackenzie King relented and said, no, they won't go over in the British uniform, they'll go over as Canadians. So they did go out there as Canadians. Most of them didn't arrive out there till the war was ended. But they stayed on, some of them, for a year or more doing duties in the surrendered territories in Java, Sumatra, and Saigon, and wherever there were Japanese speaking was needed. And they were fine young men. And I now belong, we have a veterans association connected with the school's name. S20 was the name of the school. And Nisei is the Nisei Veterans Organization, and they have an annual meeting, and most of them are in the East, and most of them have done extremely well since.
And you go to that meeting quite regularly?
I went to last year because it was in Vancouver, and they had a reunion. They'd been down to hold a reunion with the American Niseis, who were in the famous Go for Broke regiment, you know, and one of the most highly decorated regiments in the American army during the war in Italy. And they had held a big reunion, and they'd invited our fellas to go down, and they went down, and then on their way back from San Francisco or Los Angeles, I forget where it was, we had a reunion in Vancouver, and I went over for it. But I didn't know many of them because they arrived out there after I did, and they weren't at the school with me. There were none of them at the school with me when I was there. They arrived after me.
Do you think they're likely to press for the same compensation that the American Nisei has apparently been granted?
Well, those are the older people who are left, the Iseis. May do. I don't think the younger people do. They've all done fairly well off their own hook, got good jobs, many of them, some of them very high jobs in government and so on. You know, I'm one of those, and in a sense I hate to say this because I had a great liking and respect and admiration for the Canadian Japanese that I met. But there's been a lot of criticism, and still is, of the actions of the Canadian government in taking our Japanese citizens and removing them from the coast. But it's all very well to be wise after the event. You know, at Pearl Harbor, as I say, I was a young officer in charge of an isolated detachment out on the coast, and we simply didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know. And had the Japanese succeeded you know, it wasn't until the Battle of Midway, really, the threat of a Japanese invasion of the West Coast. We had absolutely nothing here, absolutely nothing to stop it. Had the Japanese wanted to land in British Columbia, they could have done so as easily as anything. There wasn't one anti-aircraft gun in the West Coast, not one. And I well remember about 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor, they sent out two Browning machine guns, and they were put up where the Greater Victoria Water District now is at Colwood. It was set up, and that was our sole anti-aircraft defense. Maybe a couple of battalions out there, one battalion of the Canadian Scottish out at Souk, sort of thing. And the Americans were just as impoverished of military defense for the first several months of the war. So, you know, what would have happened if had the Japanese staged the landing? They could have landed in Hawaii after Pearl Harbor. There was really very little to stop them. In fact, many people wondered why they didn't land in Hawaii. It is said, I'm not sure whether it's true, that when they attacked Dutch Harbor, parallel with the Midway operation in Alaska, that their original intention had been to land in Alaska, and that the only reason that they were diverted to the Aleutians was that on their way to land, they were attacked from the rear by an isolated American air base which had been established in one of the Aleutian Islands without their knowing it. And the Japanese is rather like the German. Once the plan goes wrong, he doesn't know where he is. So to their consternation, here was airplanes attacking them from the rear of their force. And then, so what they did was turned around and landed on Kiska and Attu. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not, and I don't know whether there was any plan. I've never read that there was any plan to land on the West Coast, and certainly had they landed, they wouldn't have been able to maintain themselves there. But nevertheless, coming back to what I was saying, is it's all very well now to say that we shouldn't have removed the Japanese from the coast, but that is being wise after the event. At the time, nobody knew what would happen.
At the time, it seemed...
It seemed the logical and thing to do, and the wise thing to do. And once speaking to one of the Nisei boys who came out in the first group to Calcutta, and I was bunked down with them for a day or two, I said to one of them, well, just how many of your people were loyal to Canada? And he said, well, all my generation were. We were schooled in Canada. We grew up as Canadians. We were completely loyal to Canada. That would be about a third of us. He said there was a third of most of the older people who were definitely loyal to Japan. That was where their hearts were. And the other third were neutral, but he said the way that Canada treated them, if anything, turned them over to being loyal to Japan rather than to Canada, but they couldn't do anything about it, of course. So I think undoubtedly, had the Japanese been able to land, there would have been many instances of help from the inside. Now that part, so I don't disagree with that. What I do disagree with vehemently is what was done with their property and the way it was treated. Instead of being held in public custody and returned to them intact and with compensation if necessary after the war, it was sold off, as you know, at bargain prices to anybody who wanted to pick it up. That was disgraceful. But I wasn't against, and I'm still not against, what was done to remove them from the ability to create public mischief and sabotage and whatever. We didn't know.
That's very interesting. I don't know much about this business, I must confess. Was there any kind of protest at the time on the part of Japanese Canadians?
No, very little, if any. None whatsoever. Everything was in a panic round here, you know. It was pathetic, really. Lights were put out, and there was blackouts, and again, nobody knew what was going to happen. I remember, shortly after Pearl Harbor, I was moved up to the headquarters of our coast defense at Mary Hill, and I remember being there one day. It was at Albert Head, where the big guns were, the 9.2s, and I remember one day, 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor, we were. Received a message, prepare for dire emergency. Now, I haven't a clue what it was, and it was cancelled 24 hours later, but nobody knew what was going to happen. General Stewart, the chief of staff, rushed out here, and that was a rather sad thing, really. General Alexander, who had been, and whose widow still lives in Victoria, incidentally, who was a fine man, who had been head of Pacific Command, 1940 and 41, and had been telling the government in Ottawa that it should be doing certain things around here because inevitably, sooner or later, we'd find ourselves at war with Japan, and had been largely ignored. When Pearl Harbor happened, instead of giving him the authority and so on, he was promoted to Inspector General, which was a harsh thing to do, and out rushed General Stewart, who was Chief of Staff, and made a big show, rushing around the Empress and reassuring little old ladies that everything would be all right, typical army fashion. And around here, as I say, it was absolute panic. Many people left, sold their houses, or shut up their houses and left. So civilians, many of them. It was a panicky feeling to a certain extent, everybody. Nobody knew what would happen. After Pearl Harbor, nobody quite knew whether the American fleet was in existence or not. And, with the Japanese progressing wherever they wanted to go, they were winning. You can understand it. And as I say, we had precious little, very, very few planes at all to do anything with at all. Then they did, by January, February, they began to shove stuff out to us. We had Bofors regiments and 3.2s or 3.7s, the bigger guns, coming out here, and they were sent up to Tofino, and a lot of stuff that was on its way to Europe was... I had Connie Smythe's Sportsman's Battery quartered on me for rations and quarters for a period of several weeks, his Bofors guns. And I can remember the last words he said to me when he went up to Tofino to put the guns up there. He said, "So help me, Steve, I'll get a court-martial before this war is over," and he jolly nearly did, you know. He came back from France where he'd been wounded, and I think his ammo truck blew up, and he got wounded, and he came back to France and lit into Mackenzie King. The government was a scathing attack on the reinforcement question. Because he was Connie Smythe, I guess he didn't get a court-martial, but he jolly nearly did. But things calmed down, and of course after the Battle of Midway, there was no possibility from there on in, very little of any attack here. But those 6 months were quite difficult. There were rumors, for instance, of aircraft carriers coming in to bomb. Victoria had a couple of military objectives. It had the dry dock, and it was a naval base. And they were fairly important. That dry dock was the largest dry dock under British command between here and Singapore. As you know, it took the war spite, came in here during the I remember the Warspite coming in here about 3 months before Pearl Harbor, the Queen Mary came in into dry dock here. It was a fairly substantial resource, which might have been worthwhile trying to bomb. And then, of course, over the way, even more, was Bremerton, one of the main repair bases of the U.S. Navy in Seattle. And so that there was an objective here, just whether the Japanese would have wasted any time on it or not, I don't know. But we were concerned that it was a possibility. There's a fog bank, you know, lies off the Pacific for much of the year, and there was a lot of talk that a carrier could come into that fog bank and practically get right down to Victoria or some, you know, almost without being seen. Certain amount of radar, of course, but people were scared.
What happened to you when you finally left Singapore? You were there for about 6 weeks, were you?
Yes, I went down to Singapore. Let's see, I guess I arrived in Singapore about maybe first week in September. I quite forget. And I left there, I guess it was late October. Late October. So I was there about 6 weeks doing this work. And then one day, and I'd been joined by three other Canadians on our group of 10 who had been elsewhere in the command doing various things. And they were with me in Singapore. And one day we saw two American battleships, six destroyers and a tanker, came into Singapore Harbor. And we understood that they were involved with a return to the United States. And instead of returning across the Pacific and through Panama up to Philadelphia, where they were to be decommissioned, they were too big to go through Panama, too wide with their torpedo blisters on them. So they decided to make a goodwill cruise of it from Japan. And so they came down to Singapore, and then they were going to Colombo, then down to Cape Town, and then up to Philadelphia, up the South and North Atlantic. So one of the fellows I was with said, oh, for God's sake, why don't we try and hitchhike home? You know, there's no point in us staying around here, and if we have to go home the normal way, it's, you know, a troop ship through the Mediterranean and then a transit camp in Britain and so on. So we went down that day to the American Naval Office on the docks at Singapore and said, hey, how about hitchhiking home? And much to our amazement, the chap said, well, it's up to the fellows, it's up to the captain of the ship. So they sent a wire across to the captain. He said, sure, tell them to come aboard tomorrow. All they must have is their release from their British senior officer. So I went to the head of the Psychological Warfare Department, Alex Peterson, a brilliant man, a school teacher who was in charge of all PW Division's work in Southeast Asia Command and who was in Singapore. And we got our release, and the four of us went down the next day and stepped aboard. We had 6 weeks at sea, the most beautiful return to I've ever had. Nothing to do except sunbathe and parade once a day. And the hot water, which showers, which I hadn't had for a long time. And we landed up at Philadelphia on December the 7th, the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. And we were met by the British consul from New York, who had been advised of our coming. And he put us up in a hotel at Philadelphia and said, what can I do for you? He said, we want our transport back to the West Coast. Got back to the West Coast, Military District Number 11. They said, where are you from? We said, from Southeast Asia Command, Force 136. And they said, are you prisoners of war? And I said, no, not prisoners of war. We've been down there. Well, I didn't know any Army people. Canadian Army people were down there. It must be prisoners of war, so they gave us 6 weeks leave.
I didn't quarrel with her.
I said, if you want us as POWs, that's fine with me. And that's what we were graded as. And so it was a wonderful end to a war, really. And as far as I'm concerned, and that's the way it turned out, you know, war was a funny thing. It could have been anyway, but as far as I was concerned, it was a very safe war, as a matter of fact. Apart from the flight out there and so on, I did never saw a Japanese except as a prisoner of war. But that's the way, you know, that's the way the war is. Had they decided to drop me behind the lines, it might have been something else. Although, strangely enough, the casualties in Force 136 were nothing like the casualties in SOE in Europe. Largely because you kept out of the way of the Japanese. My brother-in-law, for instance, who, as I say, was 2 years working with the... I don't know whether it was the Chins or the Karens. I think it was northern Burma, but he said they used to go out with his tribesmen, and they would waylay a little Japanese patrol and shoot them out and then vanish back into the jungle again. And most of the Force 136 types were old tea planters and people who knew the jungle pretty well, you know. And you just faded into the jungle. But there was nothing to fade into in France. You know, the Gestapo was on your tail all the time. But I should think there were probably less casualties in Force 136 by and large, and certainly than there were in the regular 14th Army, percentage-wise.
Looking back on it, if it was a safe war for you, how did the war change your life, if at all? Did you do things after the war that you might not have done in terms of career, had there not been a war?
No, I don't think I can say that. I took a veteran's grant and went over to UBC early in 46, with a view to taking law. Because I had married by then, my wife, and I had a young son, and I went over there to take my arts degree preparatory to taking law, and I was on a veteran's grant. And I remember the dean of the law school. I went to see him, and he said, "Well, are you married?" And I said, "Yes." "You've got a family?" I said, "I've got a son." He said, "Well, you've got another 3 years here to get your BA, and then you've got another 2 or 3 years, I forget which, at the law school, and then a year's articling." And he said, "By the time you're about 40, you might just be able to hang out your shingle." And I said, "Dean Curtis," I said, "thank you very much, Dean. I understand what you're saying." So I came back, and I went into business, went into the laundry and dry cleaning business, which treated me really very kindly here. And I saw Dean Curtis many years later at a function I was at, and I reminded him of this conversation, and he said, "What did you do?" And I told him, and he laughed. He said, "You know," he said, "one of my greatest admirers is a man who came to me with exactly the same questions as you have," and I told him the same thing, and he said he went out and he made a fortune making wieners, and he went down and made wieners somewhere or other, and a brand of wieners, and he'd made a million or two, and he came back to me and said, "You know, that was the best advice you ever gave me." I don't know that it altered my life particularly. I think my family and I looked at a number of businesses in Victoria and finally went into that business, but I got involved in many other ways with the community. So I think it made me more tolerant, you know, more tolerant.
More tolerant of what?
Tolerant of other people's.
Other people's
cultures. Yes, cultures, other cultures, and understanding that all cultures have their values, some of which are as great or greater than ours. Yes, I think it certainly taught me not to have any racial prejudice. I never came out of the war feeling prejudiced in a racial sense against Japan. Prejudiced against their leaders who had taken them into the war, but not prejudiced against the Japanese people.
Did you find, when you came back to Victoria with this lack of prejudice, that there was a lot of prejudice against Japanese, or more prejudice than there had been before the war?
I don't think there was among the people, the civilians of Victoria, because most of them had no experience of the war. You know, the war didn't touch Canada in that sense. But certainly among the prisoners of war, the Canadian prisoners of war from Hong Kong and so on who came back, I imagine that in many cases that prejudice will never die. My wife had a friend who was on prisoner of war, British, on the notorious Burma-Siam Railroad, the Railroad of Death. And I remember he came out and stayed with us after the war. And he said he could never see a Japanese without absolutely going berserk. never having been through that experience. And that's understandable. It's understandable that I didn't find too much prejudice here. And strangely enough, a good friend of mine at the golf club is president this year of the Japanese prisoners of war who were at Hong Kong, their association. And really, I don't think he has prejudice in that sense. So that those things are in many ways forgotten, I think. Mercifully, they should be.
I recall reading somewhere that public opinion polls in Canada at the end of the war indicated that the Japanese were the most detested of all.
Well, I think that was so even before the war, to some extent. But as a matter of fact, when I was at UBC, and even in your second year of art science, you have to write a little thesis. And my thesis was, naturally, on the Japanese problem in British Columbia. And mostly, if you trace that back, it was an economic dislike. The Japanese here before the war were a hard-working, intensely hard-working society, and they were in certain lines, fisheries, dry cleaning, for instance, laundry, and that type of thing, gardening and so on. They were beginning to take over simply because of their hard work, you know. And I think that the dislike of the British Columbia people against Orientals, and particularly against the Japanese, was basically, if you went right down to it, it was an economic reason. They feared them economically. They feared their hard work and so on, and they feared them taking jobs from the white man. And this trance never expressed itself as an economic. It became a political and a military thing, you know, and therefore all the rumors of Japanese being spies and so on and that. But basically, if you traced it right down, it was an economic thing. And of course, the war to some extent accentuated that, but I don't honestly think now that there's any dislike of Japanese people. I don't think so at all. You see them, and they come here as tourists, and I don't think there's any dislike. There may have been a lingering dislike for several years after the war, but I never really encountered it that much.
Did you ever think of going into journalism, given that you'd been done some journalism before the war and that you'd been really doing journalism with psychological warfare in a sense?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I love journalism, and originally one of my ambitions had been to be a foreign correspondent, which I would have loved, but you know, I was married, and as I say, I had a family, and there were other things began to come into it. We tried to get back, my father tried to get back into the newspaper business in Victoria by negotiating to see if we could acquire the Times and then the Colonist, and for various reasons this wasn't possible. So that that road on a local level was closed to me. I would, in many ways, I would have liked to have followed a pursued a career of writing, but writing is a very hard taskmaster, as you know. And I have probably in my case, rather than writing, it's taken the place of speechifying. I've given an enormous number of talks, and in a sense that is writing, because you have to put your thoughts down on paper, and you know, that's why I don't do it anymore, because it takes so much out of you. It's a very stern discipline indeed, is writing. And in a way, I'm glad, although I would like to have pursued it, I'm glad in some ways that I didn't. I've chosen the easier role.
What was the attraction of dry cleaning, just as a matter of interest?
Well, I always said rather jokingly that I'd aired a lot of dirty linen in my life, and now I was going to be condemned to wash it. It just happened to be a business that was for sale. We looked around, my father and I looked around at businesses. After having turned down the law, I left UBC after completing my second year arts and came over here, and we looked around for businesses to go into. As I say, we tried the newspapers, but for various reasons at the time they were closed to us. Although we did get the offer of an option of a half interest in the Colonist, but for various reasons that wasn't taken up. So we looked around, and it just happened that this particular business, the owner, who was my father, they were in the Rotary Club together, he wanted to sell. It was a good business, substantial business, a couple of hundred employees, you know, it wasn't a small little shop. It's one of the largest laundries and cleaning outfits, I suppose, in Western Canada. And it seemed to me, well, it's a means of making a livelihood. Now, it wasn't what I wanted to do in life. I enjoyed it. I made a tremendous number of friends and contacts, both in the staff and outside, among customers and so on. But it was for that reason that I began to find my own fulfillment, such as it was at a local level outside the business, in things like the Chamber of Commerce and the planning, the bond, Advisory Planning Commission of the city, and this, all these activities, the art gallery and the symphony and those sort of things, these gave me a lot of interest, and ultimately led me into local municipal life, you know, so ultimately to the mayoralty. So it was a means. I can't say that it was the thing I really wanted to do in life, but it was a means to an end, and I made many friends and enjoyed it. Enjoyed the technical aspects of it, and so on. So there we are.
Thank you very much.
Covered it pretty well.